When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This episode features Anna Turley, the former MP for Redcar. Anna lost her seat at the 2019 election. She'd been an MP for 4 years, but oh my word, a lot of stuff happened in that time. She was a former special advisor as well to David Blunkett and Hilary Armstrong, and she ended up having a protracted legal battle with Unite the Union and a website called Squawk Box, which we talk about a little bit. But this is more a conversation about what the Labour Party should be, what the reality of being an MP was like in an area that had lost its industrial base, and the reality of when you're dealing with opponents, not just inside and outside your party, but on the far left and on the far right, and when they are existing in the same space, that is something quite profound. So we talk about some very serious things and some lighter stuff about the future of the Labour Party and, of course, the Labour Party conference, which is getting underway. I've put a link, by the way, to Keir Starmer's pamphlet, The Road Ahead. You may have heard about it. It's Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, laying out his personal philosophy, I guess. I haven't read it in full yet, but I, as you know, someone who likes to read reports and manifestos and documents. And I welcome more politicians doing this sort of thing, because there are plenty of avenues for the quick soundbite, the little video that goes on Twitter. A bit more detail, a bit more background is often welcome. So even though some people seem to react to it quite violently, thinking that even the fact that he'd written a thing was ludicrous because it was too long, apparently. Well, depending on what you're doing this weekend, maybe on a Sunday afternoon, sit in your favourite chair, have a cup of tea, a Dairy Milk, and read Keir Starmer's The Path Ahead. I've put the link to it, as I often do with documents, because I think they're quite handy to read. I wish more politicians would do that. Anyway, we talk about that a little bit, so I thought I'd include it here, especially as this is just ahead of the Labour Party conference. Don't forget, you can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. The slight pause there was because I almost forgot the email address. Connor's been in touch. He says, Matt, I'm not sure I can call this nerdy, but last summer when I was volunteering with a sea turtle protection charity in Crete, I spent many a morning patrolling beaches while listening to your podcast. Thank you so much, Connor. I was also desperate to try and find a way to make reference to the podcast throughout university, given the wide range of topics and people covered. Although I didn't reference it directly, I was able to use it listening in to fill in hours on an extracurricular module where I had to spend 20 hours doing something outside of the course relating to politics. Well, it sounds, Connor, like I basically did that module for you. So I don't know if you get honorary degrees for one module, but I expect mine in the post, Connor. Don't forget, you can email the show. Why has this happened to me today? Politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. And often people get in touch with their stories of mundane or unusual places they've seen politicians. A perfectly normal place to see a politician, of course, is at the Duchess Theatre in London's glittering West End from Monday the 27th of September. My first guest is Andy Burnham, and then the show was always monthly at the other palace. It's now fortnightly at the Duchess Theatre, which is a stunning venue. It's around the corner from the Lion King. Which is just so thrilling. So the 27th of September, the Monday, the Mayor of Manchester, right at the start of Labour conference week. So depending when you listen to this, it's either in a couple of days' time, or it's tomorrow, or it's today, or yesterday, or, you know, 5 years ago, depending on when you're listening to this. But yes, the 27th of September, 2021, Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Manchester, at the start of conference week. And then a fortnight later, Penny Mordaunt, the first ever female Secretary of State for Defence. Then a fortnight after that, Caroline Flint, one of the most talented and outspoken Labour politicians of the last 15 or 20 years. And then 2 weeks after that, Anna Sarwar. 2 weeks after that, Anthony Scaramucci coming over from New York to do it. 2 weeks after that, Jeremy Hunt. 2 weeks after that, the Christmas special. And then we start again in the new year every fortnight. You can get tickets for all those shows at mattford.com/live. On to Anna Turley, who is such a positive, upbeat person and a real pleasure just to talk politics with. And one of those people who comes into politics to sort stuff out and just to get stuff done. And that relentless drive towards actually doing things is kind of... Not that it's rare at all levels of politics, but at a time when Labour's retreated into kind of the worst elements of its ideological obsession, voices like Anna Turley's were quite rare. She lost her seat at the 2019 election, and I began by asking Anna, given that it was almost 2 years since that general election, how she was finding life outside of Parliament.
I can't believe it's nearly 2 years. It's absolutely flown. And obviously, it's not been a normal time, is it, with the pandemic and everything. So, God, yeah, I mean, obviously it was a shock. I mean, I was, you know, I knew the election was, you know, going to be horrendous. I was furious with, I remember myself and Nick Dakin almost grabbing Keir, it was actually, by the lapels in the voting lobby and saying, why on earth has the Shadow Cabinet just agreed this? This is a disaster. And it was, you know, we were not looking forward to it. And a December election, I mean, my God, it was dark by 3:30 up here. It just, everything about it felt wrong. And it was in the middle of a, you know, as everyone knows, a really toxic, horrible period where Parliament was just really unpleasant. It was really tough out in, you know, particularly on social media. I mean, people in out on the doors and things were fine, but they were angry with us. They were grumpy. They were fed up. They were sick of it. And, you know, frankly, you know, for me, they'd seen me in 2017 and said, well, you know, I'm a lifelong Labour voter. I don't like your leader. Go back down there and get rid of him. But we're giving you a chance. And this time the arms were folded and there was a look of anger and rage in a lot of faces of, we told you to get rid of him. You know, why are you still here? Why are you coming back now? And it was very, very difficult. And, you know, people talk about whether it was the Brexit election, you know, get Brexit done. Of course, that had an effect. Of course it did. But my doors were 4-1 Corbyn to Brexit. This being, you know, a seat that wants to vote Labour in its heart, that is, you know, historically people would say to me, oh, my dad would turn in his grave, my granddad would turn in his grave, but they felt so kind of angry and let down by us that they broke that, you know, that long tradition. And it was heartbreaking, actually, to feel, you know, with some people when they were sticking with us, you almost wanted to clasp them by the hand and say thank you for sticking with us. You know, it was really tough. It seems a while ago. It's, you know, so much has changed, so much has happened since then. Obviously, the first year was tough, trying to kind of come to terms with the abruptness of it all, because you go from 16-hour days traveling up and down to London, you know, waking up every morning with, you know, where am I? Am I in Redcar? Am I in London? What have I got on today? What crisis is happening? What's been going on the media, on social media, to just kind of nothing. And that was, it's kind of quite a shock to the system. And I think I found January and February quite hard. You know, I didn't really want to kind of, it was difficult to go out in the local community. Just going to the shops or to the pub, I felt really, it was kind of, you know, it was embarrassing, let's be honest. You know, it was tough. It was tough to sort of go out and hold your head high. And then, of course, then lockdown came. And weirdly, lockdown meant, actually was probably, you know, horrendous as it was for the country and everything else, it was what I needed. It forced me to stop kind of trying to kind of get back into doing stuff and being hyperactive, and it forced me to have the decompression period that I think a lot of MPs need when they leave Parliament. And I found useful things to do. I got stuck in with the local food bank here, who were obviously having to shut all their warehouses and having a bit of a crisis, so I ran the phone line there for people wanting to get deliveries and vouchers. I set up a little book club for getting books to local kids, and I enjoyed living by the sea. I, you know, walked on the beach every day. I did the couch to 5K like for the people. I started painting and writing again, and, you know, enjoying life, doing the garden stuff that, you know, I just for more than the 5 years, 4.5 years as an MP, really, for, you know, most of my career, I'd just been kind of ploughing forward, working really hard, you know, aspiring, driving, and, you know, trying to deliver and be useful. And I actually, you know, enforced, you know, was enforced to take that break. And actually, you know, I think it was good. It was good for me, even though, you know, obviously there was lots of horrendous stuff happening, and, you know, I had my own personal losses and stuff. You know, it was a time that I think I needed to just reset, really. So yeah, and now I'm kind of enjoying a very different pace of life. I'm sort of doing lots of different projects, pottering, keeping an eye on, you know, what's going on, furiously tweeting all the time because it's my only outlet now, the only way that I can kind of vent and rage against the machine. So just try, you know, doing some interesting stuff, keeping busy. And you know, I think I was very keen to get into the charity sector, but found that quite difficult. There's obviously a lot of challenges in the, you know, with the charity commission and things, and I think politics was very difficult. Plus, it was a time with COVID. So I just said to myself, just take a couple of years out, do interesting things, and see where you are. And I think I'd stop putting the pressure on myself to kind of get back on the horse, get back on the next big job. And so I'm just kind of enjoying life at the moment, trying to be useful, trying to do interesting things, meet interesting people, learn new stuff, learn new skills, and yeah, who knows going forward. So.
Democracy is brutal, and arguably, in the sense that once you lose your seat, you have to go, is all correct. But is there much pastoral care? Is there much support from the parliamentary authorities or even from the party once you lose your seat?
God, no, absolutely nothing whatsoever. I mean, yeah, it is. It's brutal. I mean, it's bad enough for me, but I think about figures like Ed Balls, people who had big, big public presences, to stand on that stage on national TV and kind of be sacked. You know, yeah, it is brutal. And the moment you step off that platform, that's it. It's over. You are, you know, you're in a way, you know, you're yourself again. And actually, I woke up the next morning, and because of the extent of the abuse and the stuff that I'd been getting on social media, one bit of me, you know, I'll be honest, there was a sort of relief that I don't have to endure, I don't have to go to bed last thing at night with people telling me about all the, you know, friends telling me about all the awful stuff that was written on social media, or waking up first thing in the morning and checking your feed to see, you know, I felt relief from that. But after that, there is absolutely nothing. So I think we got a nice letter from Keir. I think we got a nice letter from Jeremy. But they were kind of, you know, pro forma letters that went to everybody. There was nothing. I expected to start, like, something from the whips or something from the party. There is absolutely nothing. And I am hugely, enormously grateful to friends, who picked up the phone, who checked in, who kind of, you know, had positive suggestions. Other people who'd lost their seats in the past, were who I didn't, you know, particularly know, made the effort to reach out. Like, you know, there was an informal network. I think the Tories are much, much better at kind of reaching out and looking after each other than we are.
Why
I
is
was
that, Gillian?
surprised, and you know, it wasn't so bad. I think, I mean, inevitably, there's the sort of, you know, the priority is the party. I totally get that. The priority is the country. So it's like, right, you know, where do we go from here? We had a leadership election to deal with. You know, I totally understand everyone's focus was on that, and you know, I had no problem with that at all, because, you know, in the day, we're all just doing our bit for the party in whatever way that is, putting our shoulders to the wheel. So I don't feel like I needed, you know, I just done my bit for the party. That was all. I tried to do my bit for the party. But there were colleagues who, and you know, I was lucky because I don't have dependents. You know, I've got really loving family and friends, and I have a hinterland outside of politics, so it was fine for me. I had, you know, had my support networks. But I know there were colleagues who, you know, had three children, and suddenly, you know, you're losing your income. People think MPs get this big payoff, but it's about a month. You know, you get about a month's salary. And so there were colleagues with kids who I was worried about. There were obviously people like Paula Sheriff going through her breast cancer situation. You know, there are a lot of people that I think were really kind of struggling, and I'm not sure that support was there. And I definitely think going forward, the party has to do that. I think for some, as I say, some colleagues were absolutely lovely and, you know, reached out. Other colleagues didn't, and that was a surprise. And you think, I think sometimes maybe there was a bit of sort of survivor's awkwardness there, that people kind of, you know, didn't know what to say or what to do. I don't know. But you know, I'm not going to be self-indulgent about it. You know, they say the priority is the party, and the disaster was for the party, not for me. You know, the disaster was the Labour Party's worst election results since the 30s, and, you know, absolute devastation, and a Tory government that's now wreaking havoc. So that was the tragedy of December the, you know, 13th. That not us.
But you talk about the party's priorities being the country, and that's correct. But the Labour Party also calls itself the People's Party. It tells itself, and indeed it tells everyone else, that it's more moral and more caring. Yet it doesn't seem to look after its own very well.
Well, I think that there's definitely stuff that they can put in place, I think, for future. And I think people, you know, I have some sympathy, because your focus right up until the 12th of December is winning, and that's the absolute priority. And then your focus on the 13th of December is, you know, moving forward, getting a new leader, sorting the party out, dealing with the devastation. And so, yeah, you know, I'm sure you're right, but, you know, we all play our role in the party, don't we? We're not there for ourselves. We're there to put our shoulders to the wheel, to pass the torch, to support other people, to you know, do stuff for the future. So I don't feel any kind of bitterness or anger towards the party about that. I just think, you know, it should be, there's stuff that should be put in place on a practical level. It's a management thing, and I'd hope going forward, and I'd be happy to kind of help, you know, discuss that with people about what they can do. But as I said, you know, we are the priority is getting the party ready for the next election and putting the public first, really.
You talk about the relief of not having to check your mentions on Twitter and see what you know, awful things people have said. To be clear on where those awful comments were coming from, are you talking about your political opponents inside or outside of the party?
It was both. It was, 2019 was horrendous for someone like me, who was kind of trying to take a very difficult and challenging position on Brexit, where, you know, I knew I had a 6-7% Leave seat, and, you know, I voted to trigger Article 50 because I wanted to make that work, and, you know, I believed in democracy, whatever the flaws with the democracy around that referendum. But increasingly, as time went on, I couldn't support something. I was getting more and more evidence from chambers of commerce, from local businesses, from, you know, ironically, I think about energy companies that we had before us in the select committee now, you know, story after story about what was happening. And I just thought, I can't support this. I cannot endorse this. And having been through the closure of the steelworks very early in my time as an MP, 2,300 people losing their jobs overnight, the devastation that created in the community, the knock-on effect to a community that was already struggling from high unemployment and deindustrialization, high levels of poverty, I just couldn't endorse an action that was going to make people here worse off, with all the things that we're seeing now and more to come. So I, you know, it's difficult and challenging to take that position. And so I got, you know, obviously the far right in the northeast had a real kind of vendetta, and they really targeted female MPs. So, you know, myself, Bridget, Ellen Goodman, Julie Elliott, you know, there was a lot of coordinated activity that was flagged up to me by anti-fascist groups, actually, in the northeast. Particularly targeted around us as women. And so that had become extremely difficult. You know, I'd had to have, like many female MPs, all the security on my house, office got vandalised, stuff like that. That was hard. And in many ways, that was the most heartbreaking thing, because I'd worked really hard right from when I was first elected in 2012 to be on my community's side, to fight for them, to stand up for them, to make sure that I was carrying their voice to Parliament, to feel like I was really, you know, speaking on their behalf. And it felt like there was a sort of deliberate wedge being exploited and created by people calling us, you know, traitors, and, you know, saying we're not respecting the referendum, and trying deliberately to stoke a division between us and the community. And that was very difficult and frustrating and painful to try and say to people, look, you know, I've just got to, I'm trying to do what's in the best interests of this area. I'm not just going to, you know, harm this area just because you're telling me it's going to be fine. I don't believe you. So the stuff from the far right was really, really difficult and became very toxic. And social media can really flip suddenly. I mean, one of the things I spent the following year kind of reflecting on and doing some work on was the use of Facebook and social media in local areas, and particularly sort of local community groups, which, you know, had been set up sort of to say they're non-political, but really followed a political agenda. And I think the Tories were very, very kind of heavily involved in this, working with a lot of independents and so on. And you could really see a shift in kind of small M momentum over that last year, where those groups got taken over, where stuff got shared, where lies were perpetrated in those groups. I mean, there were some classics like, yeah, I was a millionaire, I lived in London, I had a gay lover in London, you know, all sorts of things, you know, were going around on these groups that were just complete nonsense. And you couldn't halted it. And the worst thing was, you know, I remember knocking on a door and someone saying, "Oh, I'm not going to vote for you because you fell asleep in Parliament." And I said, "What are you talking about? Of course, I didn't fall asleep in Parliament. Where's this come from?" And it turned out there's like a photograph going around that had been doctored to sort of look like my eyes were shut when I'm sort of looking down. And this, you just, you know, it was really quite a incredible to see the effect that social media, hyperlocal social media, could have on kind of creating or destroying, you know, reputations and narratives. So that was very, very difficult, kind of in terms of the far right. Going back to your original question, yeah, you know, it was really, really difficult getting stuff from the far left. Obviously, there's my well-documented Unite case, which was, you know, extremely time-consuming, extremely emotionally difficult, and just frankly ridiculous. But you know, you've got to stand up. If someone libels you, you've got to stand up for yourself. And you know, so I felt kind of under siege from there. We were going through our re-selections. I mean, that was 3 months of my re-selection. But we had, you know, I was re-selected because four of the first four branches had their meetings. But we were still waiting on one more branch to decide before I could formally say I'd been re-selected. And then the election came, and it was 3 months of wasted energy having these battles on, you know, re-selections, meetings that were grotesque. There were people joining with the far right on these sites, on these far right sites, to attack and abuse me, to lie about me, to, you know, just spread misinformation. It was, yeah, it became so toxic from both sides. It was really quite, yeah, it was unpleasant.
So people from the far left were on the same sites as the people on the far right.
Yeah. We had Labour Party members leaking information about our CLP meetings. We had them on there talking about openly about trying to deselect me
To the
on the
far
on far right
right.
sites. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So yeah, so these were far right groups. I mean, obviously they were, you know, broader membership, but they were initiated by the far right and
Yeah.
by anti-Brexit kind of, you know, toxic people. And yeah, members of the Labour Party were joining that. This is what, you know, this is what we were all dealing with. And a lot of MPs won't sort of talk about it because we have this, you know, you don't want to kind of expose the kind of nasty underworkings of your party, but this is the reality. And many colleagues were facing a lot worse than me on this as well. This is where we were, I'm afraid.
Just before we come on to the hard left and the legal case and everything, when, because I'm always fascinated by this, and I'm never entirely sure what the answer is, but I remember, I don't know if you remember a guy called Ian Riley who used to work for the Labour Party, but I remember he always used to say, you know, you'd always get candidates going, "Oh, the Lib Dems have put out a leaflet about me and it's full of spurious lies." And he always used to say, if candidate A says that candidate B is a paedophile, the last thing candidate B should do is put out a leaflet saying, "I'm not a paedophile." So you kind of amplify the message. Now, that picture of you that was doctored of you being asleep is very different to being accused of being a paedophile. But nevertheless, you're in a situation where, of course, it's nonsense, but and you have to rebut it. But equally, rebutting it kind of draws attention to it. So what is the best thing to do, and how did you handle it?
Well, so it's really at the time my priority was just getting on with my job. You know, I was dealing with Brexit, I was dealing with, say, all the issues around high unemployment. You know, so much going on, huge amount of casework. That was my priority. So I was kind of very, very focused on my work. And you know, so the worst thing was you'd get really lovely party members, really supportive people sending you stuff at 10 o'clock saying, "Oh my God, have you seen what they're saying about you?" And
Oh
I just
no.
said, "Look, this is just Facebook. It's just Facebook trolls. Let's just ignore it. You know, let's just crack on." But then when you lose and you think, "My, like, it's really hard to know, to extrapolate what effect that stuff had." But I know, you know, it did damage my kind of personal reputation. So, you know, whether or not that made a difference, I don't know. So it's only afterwards, on the reflection, when I then spent time in my year with not much to do, going through these Facebook sites and looking at stuff. And I actually, you know, I ended up complaining to Facebook about some of the stuff. So I typed into this kind of one group that was set up to have a go at me, and I just typed in the word bitch to just to see, and there were 35 uses of that word. And so I just screenshotted that and sent that to Facebook, and was just like, how can you allow these sites that are unmoderated, that are, and you know, they, and it was almost like what was difficult in those groups was that people were almost like competing as to who could kind of have the strongest, most aggressive view about me. Some would say, oh, well, you know, if I saw her, I'd blah, blah, blah. And some would say, well, if I saw her, I'd blah, why don't we smash her windows in, or blah, blah. And it was almost like people were kind of competing as to who'd be the most aggressive. Now, these, you know, these could just be kind of Facebook trolls. When you're walking your dog in the street, or you're walking through the high street to go and see a charity, or, you know, do something in your community, you don't know who's walking towards you. And it's so hugely unsettling, because, you know, you're seeing this stuff knowing it's in a local group, and, you know, these are people that are living in your area. So that was difficult. So it's hard to sort of extrapolate. You know, I tried to ignore it, as I say, at the time. But did we trick? I think the broader lesson for the party and for candidates and people going forwards is to really monitor these, particularly the local sites, not so much the sites set up to attack you. I don't think there's much you can do about that. But what we were finding on groups that are like, you know, you're from X When or X and, you know, Grange Channel Proud or Redcar Blog or whatever, you know, everyone has these groups in their areas, is to just make sure that you don't allow a narrative to run on there, and that you have party members, you have friends, you have people rebutting all the time and challenging and promoting good positive stuff. Because it's hard, because what we found was people would go on there and defend me, and then they'd get blocked from the group because of the, you know, the admins were political. So my suggestion would be everyone to keep an eye on these groups, because there is a whole conversation happening there, which is where people are getting their views and their perspectives on politics. Because let's be honest, they're not buying Guardian, they're not even possibly a lot of them buying the Mirror. You know, they're getting their views from their friends and their peers and their neighbours on social media, on Facebook in particular. And we just weren't there in that debate. And I was saying, as I said, you know, that it's just Facebook trolls. Let's just keep on with doing our positive stuff on our site, paying for our adverts, pushing stuff out. But there was another whole conversation happening in these groups that we weren't aware of. Now, as I say, you know, how much effect that had on the result, who knows? But I spent the year afterwards thinking, I think, you know, we missed the trick. And that all came up really in the last year. It didn't exist really in 2015, you know, when I was first selected. It was very much a sort of post-2016, and particularly that last year, it really sort of mushroomed.
It must be, I mean, I've seen abuse people get on social media. I've seen abuse I get. I think the abuse that women get is far worse, that women MPs get is particularly distressing. I mean, it's easy to go, oh, it's just trolls. But when you're reading stuff about yourself and it's local, and as you say, these people are competing to be as violent about you as they can. I mean, there must have been times when you did feel unsafe.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I worried about my staff a lot as well. You know, my caseworker sort of work, you know, walking home dark early to her car. Like, there was lots of, you know, yeah, it was unpleasant. And in the back of our minds all the time was Joe. And I think that's another thing that I found. It became a bit of a sort of perpetuating thing where we got police advice saying, don't advertise where you're going. And, you know, in 2015, I loved just having a street store in the high street. I always advertised my surgeries. I always kind of said where I was going. And after Joe was killed, we had to stop doing that. So surgeries became appointment only. And I my frustration there was that I actually felt that I was getting a bit more disconnected from the community, because I couldn't just pop up and do stuff or advertise where I was going to be and say, come and see me, come and chat, come and have a coffee morning. It became much more difficult in the climate to do stuff like that. So it sort of perpetuated a thing where you felt like you got more disconnected. And it was, you know, it was very difficult. And as I say, you just, you know, a lot of it was just, you know, was a sort of social media thing, because knocking on doors, people were always unfailingly lovely and chatted. And even if they weren't voting, they would explain their reasons or their disappointment. And, you know, they might have a kind of moan and a chunter, but, you know, we never got anything. I think one colleague got some abuse, and he was an ex-army officer. So, you know, they got pretty short shrift. But on the whole, you know, in the three elections in 4.5 years, we didn't have anything on the doorstep. People were always kind of unfailingly nice. But yeah, there was something about social media that just enabled this discussion and this conversation to take place. And you never knew whether it would spill out or not. And that's the uncertainty.
So you've got all that going on. And at the same time as facing re-selection, then re-election, you're fighting this legal case against a blog site called Squawk Box, which some listeners may be aware of. It's a pro-Corbyn, hard-left I don't know how you would describe it. News site isn't the right phrase. It's basically a sort of gossip site. And you're fighting a legal case at the time against them and Unite the Union. So just take us through it from the start. How did that begin?
Well, they'd print, I think it was prior to the 2017 elections, they were having quite a concerted effort, I think, to undermine moderate MPs. And I'd seen a few articles about my colleague Tom Blenkinsop and stuff, and they printed one about me that was untrue and libelous. So again, at the time I was thinking, like with most things, do I ignore it, do I just bother, and I thought, well, no, because this was a serious accusation of fraud, and I thought that will just linger, that will just stay there, and people will keep pointing to it. And I thought, I'm just not having it. So I approached a libel lawyer recommended to me by a friend, and yeah, you know, we wrote to them, and the information that they'd used had been leaked to them, we believe, by Unite. And so, you know, we approached them both, asked them to retract and remove it. They didn't. And it went on for, you know, what was it, best part of 2 years, incredibly, all the way to the court. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. You know, we made numerous offers to settle, but they were rejected. And, you know, I thought, you can't back down in these situations. You've got to going. And I was very lucky to have, you know, great lawyers and, you know, insurance, because it was such a clear cut case. And, you know, it went all the way. And, you know, I was very, very pleased the judge found in my favour. But I mean, what a shameful and appalling waste of union members' money to pursue a vendetta through the courts. And worse, and the judge, you know, actually sort of raised this, was that they used the court process to continue to try and double down on further libel. So they got their QC in the courtroom to say that I was not fit to be an MP. And this was a week into the 2019 election. So, of course, the splash on the front page of my local paper, the Gazette, was not fit to be an MP. So, you know, it's like it was incredible that they used the process to just continue to double down. And, you know, ultimately to the cost of over £2 million of members' money. Appalling, absolutely appalling.
So on what basis did they say you were not fit to be an MP?
Well, they tried to, because they weren't winning their case, they tried to turn it around and say that I was a liar, that I'd lied through this case, that everything was fabricated. And that was their, and their QC tried to say, essentially in his introductory comments said, I've got a mountain to climb to prove this, but essentially acknowledging that he was given a political statement to make. So it was, you know, it was, and the judge, you know, as I say, in his statement, recognised this, and that's why the damages I got were substantial.
So in the court bit, was Len McCluskey there? Did those people turn up?
Howard Beckett was there. No, Len wasn't there. Howard was there, but you know, they made a great. I think one of the reasons why they were so keen on this vendetta was because a while before I'd sent a tweet referring to Len McCluskey as an arsehole, and they were obviously so annoyed about that. I think that was part of the root cause why they viewed this so vigorously. So of course that was brought up in the courtroom, and they tried to make me apologise for that. But I said, you know, the whole point in this case is you're trying to prove that my integrity, and it would be disingenuous of me to say that's not the case and apologise, because it remains my view. So that, that didn't go down particularly well, but it was, you know, it's the truth. So in my opinion, so, but no, Len wasn't there, but Howard Beckett was very much there and very much the driving force behind all of this, including, you know, the accusations made against me and lengthy attempts to further smear me through the process of that case.
So surreal to have one of the biggest funders of the Labour Party attacking a Labour MP. No, I mean, Unite were closer to Jeremy Corbyn than any other trade union. Did Jeremy Corbyn ever get in touch with you? Did he ever offer any help? Did the party ever offer any help?
No. No, I don't think so. I mean, no, definitely not. It was very isolating, really. And there was a number of, you know, Unite wrote to a number of other MPs who had been mentioned in kind of WhatsApp groups and things to try and reel them in, which is one of the hardest things about it, actually, because I, you know, I was quite happy to fight this myself, and you know, it was my decision to do it. But I was, you know, it was pretty awful that they tried to bring other MPs into this as well. But that was part of the political sort of agenda behind the case. So, but no, there was never any contact. Again, it was, you know, it was friends and colleagues, people saying, brilliant, good on you, you know, thank, well done for standing up to them, good luck, you know, they're the mafia, you know, you must be mad, but good luck to you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Because you'd served for a while in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow team for less than a year. You were the shadow minister for civil society under Jeremy Corbyn from 2015 to 2016. How surreal was that period?
Well, I mean, I'd always got on well with Jeremy. I'd lived in Islington North for 4 years. He was my MP. We had a good relationship. I campaigned for him. You know, we went to Labour Party events. We went, you know, went door knocking together. I was, you know, I liked him as a guy, as a constituency MP, in the full knowledge, as was okay then. People disagreed about stuff. You knew you had a spectrum of people in the Labour Party. You knew you had people with different views and perspectives, and that was just how it was. And you kind of, you know, you muddled through. And but obviously, it was, you know, I would always have said that I didn't believe he was fit to be leader of the Labour Party. Nice as he was, he just wasn't going to win an election. And that, for me, is the fundamental purpose of the leader of the Labour Party, the person you're putting forward to be Prime Minister. That was, you know, I was always kind of open about that, but I was honoured to serve in the cabinet, because I think we were all at that point saying, okay, you know, let's just make the best of it. He's been elected by the members. Let's make things work. You know, we just lost the election. We wanted to, you know, set out a sort of good path forward. And the opportunity to work on, you know, sort of policy working with charities in the third sector was really important for me, because, you know, personally believe how, you know, they're massively fundamental to tackling the big problems that we face in society. So I was really excited about setting a programme, working with them, and, you know, and seeing what we could do and developing policy for the Labour Party. But after Brexit, you know, I had to resign. I was so mortified that we'd lost. I was so appalled by the lack of campaigning, the lack of cut through to core voters, Labour voters, that enough was enough. And when the no confidence motion came through, I signed it because, as I said, I was clear that I didn't believe he was going to win an election, therefore should not be leader of the Labour Party, and, you know, should stand down. That was my expectation, that if someone didn't have the support of their members of parliament, had an 80% no confidence motion, whether you're a teacher or a, you know, working in a any sort of team or in a football dressing room, you know, if you lose the support of 80% of your staff, I think you would question whether you're there to carry on. And so that, you know, it was very, very frustrating to then see the sort of stitch up that was done at the NEC, and then the subsequent campaign, the chicken coup, all of this sort of stuff that was turned to their advantage, to say that we'd overturned members' rights and all this sort of stuff. Well, I'm sorry, that was the constitution of the Labour Party. We were constitutionally entitled to pass a motion of no confidence in the leader. That was, you know, and that was our view. That was very strongly my view after Brexit.
Yes, and the public agreed with you, which is a sort of crucial point in all this, is that you're absolutely in tune with the country in your assessment of Jeremy Corbyn. It looks like Keir Starmer might try and change the rules around how the Labour Party selects its leader. It'll be one of many Labour leaders that have changed the rules in one direction or the other. Presumably that's a rule change that you'd support.
Yeah, it is actually. I think I might have written something on this a few years ago. I think it's absolutely right. It's not to say that MPs' votes should count more than members or anything like that, but there is a fundamental issue here, which is that you know, we live in a democracy. We live in a parliamentary democracy where you're essentially electing the first among equals of your members of parliament to lead the party. And no one sees more closely the members of parliament, how other MPs do in parliament. We're sat in a chamber for hours. We're sat, you know, we sat in these committees. You see who can lead, who can communicate, who can engage with people, who can get stuff done, who can achieve change, and who's got an analysis of where the country is, where the public is, what the party should be doing. We just, you know, by virtue, not by being better, but by being in those positions, we are in the best place to judge that, in my view. And I think, you know, particularly with social media now, maybe this is the way politics is going in terms of sort of creating a populist persona-based politics. We see it successfully with Boris Johnson. But my feeling was, watching the leadership, the two leadership elections, was that it's very easy to create an image of a leader through social media, through clipping videos, through rallies, through blah, blah, blah. You can create, and everyone can project onto this person what they want them to be. But the reality is, actually, it's those that are there day in, day out, seeing how people perform and contribute, who are the ones that know who's up to it. And people say, you know, I only spoke at the PRP a couple of times, you know, as a backbencher. I never had to present to the PRP. But speaking in the PRP is one of the most terrifying things. And I think every Labour MP would agree with that. It's ferocious. You are being judged by your peers who are very, you know, have very, very high standards of what they want from their leader and their front bench. And so, you know, I'm frustrated that in all this discussion debate, I'm not actually hearing many people set out the reasons why we should go back to the electoral college. Rather, you know, there are fundamental reasons why it matters, as well as, you know, the importance of the trade unions in this process. And, you know, I know we've just had that long conversation, but I'm proud trade unionist. I'm a big believer in the role of trade unions, big believer in their contribution when it's positive to the party. And, you know, I think it's vital to me that they have a fundamental role in this, and their members crucially have a fundamental role in this. You know, when trade unions go bad and you know, people exploit individuals to their own ends, it's a disaster. But trade unions properly run and trade union members properly having their say is fundamental to the lifeblood of this party. So, you know, I think the electoral college is the best place to best way forward. But you know, people would say, well, you would say that, but it comes from, you know, my experience of watching and scrutinizing colleagues and recognizing what are the skills that are best needed for someone to lead the party, win an election and govern.
Also, I mean, this sort of possibly started during the Ed Miliband period, definitely became popular during the Jeremy Corbyn period, is MPs should have more of a say. And I don't understand why more MPs don't say that. They seem terrified of their own members. This whole stuff about party democracy, the public don't care. They expect the people who actually have to do the job to be given the powers in order to do it. They don't want Labour MPs to constantly have to go through re-selections. You know, most of the public, when they find a Labour leader that they're willing to vote for, and as we know, there haven't been many, there's only been one in our lifetime, they don't care what the Labour Party membership think. They probably think the whole thing's a massive distraction that actually holds those people back from being better leaders. So MPs themselves, as a bloc, have to defend their right to have more power. They are elected members of Parliament. That should come. And it's not a privilege. It's not a status thing. It's a necessary part of the job.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's, you know, it was really difficult during that sort of Corbyn era to look at colleagues and see people who were deliberately on all sorts of policy areas, but just on anti-Semitism is the classic, people who are not willing to stand up for this most fundamental anti-racist issue because they were terrified of their members. It was quite a shock and quite an eye opener to me. And I just thought that was really sad. And, you know, it's horrible feeling like you're at war with your members. And I had some really, really challenging GCs, you know, on issues like Syria, but I think, you know, also on the Skripal poisonings. I remember, you know, having to stand up and being told that, you know, MI5 was behind this and, you know, why aren't we working with Russia on the sample? Like, it was, you know, there was some genuinely just like, unbelievable. Yeah, yeah, honestly, you know, being heckled when you're trying to kind of explain, you know, this in a parliamentary report. So that there is some real issues. You know, we have fantastic members. I love our Labour Party membership, but we can't not acknowledge the fact that our membership inevitably is to the left of where the public are. That is why they have joined the Labour Party. And so MPs have to do that really difficult thing of challenging their membership, taking them to where the public are, and, you know, making sure that they can sort of be, you know, a bridge. And that's why they have a really important role in this. But I think the nature of our system, and particularly the re-selection, means that it's really difficult for MPs to challenge their party membership, to disagree with their party membership. And that's why, you know, we end up in a really difficult situation. That's what I think is one of the biggest challenges for this party going forward. The Tories don't care about that. You know, they're too far the other way, but they're so fundamentally, ruthlessly focused on power that they don't give a monkey's about their members, if they've even got any. I'm not even sure they have any Tory members in Redcar and Cleveland, hardly a handful. You know, Jacob Young, the Tory MP here, proudly said he didn't knock on a single door at the last election. You know, they're not that whole infrastructure that we, you know, believe in, that is the lifeblood of our party, they have absolutely no interest in, and it enables them to be utterly, utterly ruthless. You know, I'm not suggesting we go down their path, but a bit more of a focus on our clause one would be nice.
Yes, to actually form a government, for people not au fait with the Labour Party constitution.
Sorry, yeah.
As you or I might be.
The fundamental purpose of the Labour Party, yeah.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Before you became an MP, in fact, many years before, you were a special advisor under the previous Labour government to David Blunkett and then to Henry Armstrong. You were a spad to David Blunkett when he was at Work and Pensions. What was he like to work for?
He was brilliant. I mean, I started off actually as a civil servant in the Home Office. So I was, you know, formally politically neutral. I started off as a sort of graduate on the Fast Stream scheme. And that was brilliant. Worked on youth crime, worked on closing the Sangatte refugee centre in France, on what we called just juxtaposed controls then, which was about sort of stopping illegal migration in France. Lots of lessons for Priti Patel, I'm happy to talk to her about. David was phenomenal. And then when he resigned in... from being Home Secretary, or was sacked, whatever way you want to describe it, I went to work with him in Parliament. I'd had enough of the civil service. I was frustrated that it just felt very kind of slow, very bureaucratic. And, you know, I realised that actually politics was how you got things done, how you made things happen, and was about your values and what you believe in and what you stood for. And I realised that I couldn't hand on heart say that I was a civil servant that would serve any party of the day, because I knew what my values were. And so I sort of kind of made that shift into politics. And working for David was probably a big part of inspiring me to do that, actually, because he was phenomenal. Everything he did, every decision he made, had the people of Sheffield Brightside at the heart of it. He had a phenomenal antennae for where the British public were and what they wanted him to do. But more than that, the thing that I got most from working for him was his absolute relentless pursuit of change and progress. He was exhausting. You know, you come in the morning to 12, 15 voicemails on your phone where he'd been working until 2 in the morning, kind of really angry about this. Why hasn't this been done? Make this happen. And civil servants would just kind of roll their eyes in frustration. And I realise now that's what 18 years of opposition does to you. When you've sat on the back benches and you've endured 18 years of a Tory government, my God, you make every minute count when you get into government. And that was the biggest thing that I learned and took from David, that he, you know, you, and I always say to people, you never know in politics, and it, you know, proved to be true, whether you have 6 months or 6 years, you know, you never know how long you've got in the job. So you have to kind of make every single day count and try and achieve as much as you can in the time you've got. And David was like that, and it was phenomenal to be able to work for him. And we're still great friends now. And you know, he's a much more relaxed fun person to be around now than he was as Home Secretary. But that kind of anger and desire for change has never left him.
So had you been a member of the Labour Party before you joined the civil service, or was that when your kind of political awakening happened?
No, I was a Labour voter. So I was 18 in 1997. So that was just phenomenal for me. in 78, I never didn't know anything but a Tory government growing up, and I just remember that feeling of like throwing off the shackles, casting my first vote, you know, new dawn broken, is it not? You know, it was amazing. I, you know, at the age of 18, looking around the country, it just seemed so full of unemployment, so unfair, so unequal, so much homelessness, so much, you know, just so much strife. And it was just, you know, so, you know, I was very much of that era of, you know, this was something powerful and fantastic, and things could be different. And oh my God, a Labour Party that looked like normal people. It had women in it. It had disabled people in it. It spoke in different accents and normal accents. You know, it was fantastic. And it was what I'd seen on my telly, you know, growing up. So that was, I was, you know, in, sort of inspired from that. But I didn't join the party really until, well, I joined while I was a civil servant in the Home Office, and started to get more and more kind of closer to the politics and more aware of you know, the power of politics to drive change, rather than the kind of civil service digging the heels in sort of approach.
And where did your politics come from? Were your parents political?
Not at all. So I come from I had a sort of middle class upbringing, but I come from really originally a working class family. So my grandparents on my mum's side, my granddad was a dustman. On my dad's side, is a bus driver and then a lorry driver. My mum was a secretary. My dad left school at 15 without any qualifications, got a job as a coffee boy in a bank, and then graduated from the coffee machines to the Xerox machines, and then the Xerox machines to the computers in the 80s. And if you get into computers in the City of London in the 80s, you kind of do all right. But I think they voted, if they did vote, they voted Conservative. I know my grandparents were working class Conservative voters. So I kind of grew up, I guess, with that sort of working class sort of aspiration. But I guess for me, it was very much sort of, it was growing up in the 80s, and it was that kind of new Labour. I think I always had a sense of a social conscience, but it was never politically articulated, because I didn't come, you know, we weren't a family that sat around the dining table and had chats about politics. You know, we sat and watched the telly, you know, with dinner on our laps. So for me, it's been forged myself by my experience, by looking around me, you know, by understanding the world around me, and then seeing what change can do from inside government. And that's, I think, why I'm a very sort of practical person in terms of winning elections and getting stuff done. I'm not ideology has kind of bore me. You know, I have very strong values, very clear values on social justice. And for me, the Labour Party is the only party that has ever achieved those things. You know, the entire 20th century says to me that the Labour Party is the party that does the good stuff. You know, that is the story of our history. And I'm, you know, that's why for me, the Labour Party is the greatest vehicle for social progress. And that's why I want to put my shoulder to the wheel and make it happen. But it's also why I think I'm so hugely frustrated when it fails to have that purpose and just gets self-indulgent and unrealistic, because I'm a very kind of practical person who wants practical change and, you know, wants it now.
You won a scholarship to a school called the Ashford School, which is a boarding and day school. I mean, you're the least boarding school person I've ever met. we were boarders. Did you stay there?
No, God, no. No, yeah, I got an academic scholarship. I'd been kind of bullied a bit in primary school and stuff. And I think for being a girly swat, basically, I was probably really annoying. I was always the front of the class, the hand up, doing my homework. I was really, really good. And I think that was pushed by my mum, because she was able to stay on and do her A-levels, but only because the school had to write to my grandparents and basically demand that she get to stay and do her A-levels. My grandparents wanted her to go and get a job. And my mum was really, really bright, is really bright, and never got opportunity. Obviously, you know, neither of my parents went to university or anything like that. And I think my mum felt a little bit aggrieved. She loved school, that she never got the opportunity to kind of achieve what she could have achieved and study. So she always pushed us to kind of work hard and take our opportunities at school and stuff. So as I said, I was a proper kind of girly swat. And so then getting a scholarship to brilliant school, and at the age of 11, God, I didn't have any socialist values. I thought, wow, I get to go to a school that's got tennis courts, and you know, I get to do plays, and I get to learn languages, and I was just really excited by that. But then it was quite a shock to the system, because, say, although we were sort you know, we were sort of barely middle class. There was a lot of kind of landed families there and stuff. And I think, you know, I definitely developed a bit of a sort of class awareness there, which then went on into Oxford as well. And I wouldn't say I'm a chip on the shoulder type of person, but I can definitely see, I have a bullshit radar for people from a certain class and background. And, you know, I do like to, you know, poke them and annoy them and resent them. So yeah, I think, you know, being kind of exposed to that, I see that, I do feel like I see their ways. And, you know, but I was so lucky. It was very much an academic school. It wasn't really, you know, it was very focused on achievement and stuff. So again, I just worked hard, played in all the sports teams, I've always taken all the opportunities that have come my way and tried to make the most of how lucky I've been. I'm very conscious how lucky I've been in my life, and I've always grabbed everything that's come my way to make the best of it, and hopefully give stuff back as well. So,
as well as being a Labour MP, you were also chair of the Cooperative Party. And obviously there have been Labour and Co-op MPs. I used to work for one. Andy Reid was Labour and Co-op. What does the Co-op Party do that the Labour Party doesn't?
I love the Co-op Party so much. Honestly, like, it's just, it's got no edge to it. Like, all the people, I found the people there so sort of, honestly, the people in the Co-op Party are lovely. They're kind of really committed. And I really liked the values of, you know, of equality, of people having a stake. There's something I think the Co-op Party speaks to around self-help, as well as kind of cooperation and working together. And that's always been a core part of my views, whether it's on kind of Brexit or anything else, or fundamentally, you know, you achieve more than, you know, than you achieve, we achieve alone. It's for me, fundamentally, is the idea of working together and working in partnership and cooperation. And I always found the Co-op Party a very positive place to be on all of its campaigns, because it's always about working together, about partnership, about helping people to help themselves and do the best they can. And I just, you know, it's, there's a really, really great place for the Co-op Party, I think, particularly in politics, because we all talk about, you know, Brexit and the big issues, and whether people in, whether it's Redwall or where else, feeling alienated, feeling like they don't have a place in politics, that they feel powerless against big global corporations or in democracy generally, or in the way services are delivered to them, like council works. All we talk all the time about this lack of voice and lack of power for people, and that's what goes fundamentally to the heart of the Co-op Party, is about people having power, people having voice, people having a say, people working together to make that happen, rather than services or organizations doing stuff to people. And I just think it's kind of never been more important than now, really. So yeah, I love the Co-op Party. I think, you know, it's a fundamental sort of strand of the Labour Party with a great history and a very relevant future, I think. So, love it.
One of the things you had to deal with as an MP, obviously in the northeast of England, in Redcar, was the sort of closure of the steelworks, really, and the legacy in the community. And you were able to get huge amounts of money out of the government for ex-steelworkers. As a Labour MP, getting that help from a Conservative government, that must have taken incredible effort and skill.
Yeah, I mean, you're always your worst critic. I'm angry that the steelworks shut. That didn't need to happen. They could have kept that open. They could have had some form of state aid to keep it going until a buyer was found, as the Labour government had done in 2010. It didn't need to happen. It was an act of industrial vandalism, and it threw, you know, as I said, over 2,000 people on the dole, plus the ripple out effect of people that I spoke to, people who worked in hairdressers, in in news agents, in local shops. Everyone was affected because people had less money in their pocket, and to take that money out of a local economy, which was, say, already on its knees, already struggling with austerity, already still feeling the implications of the crash, was just cruel and brutal and needless, and just felt like another kick in the teeth to people here who feel like they're always crapped on, frankly, that nobody cares, that nobody stood up for them. And, you know, all of that, I think, fed into the kind of Brexit stuff and a lot of the issues that you see, you know, Andy Burnham talking and others talking about around kind of the London sense of things. You know, people do feel that they're ignored and they're taken for granted. And so that was hugely, hugely powerful. And so my, you know, it was desperate. My job for the, you know, first really year of being an MP was just to try and help as many people as possible in the face of this terrible tragedy. And that was, you know, the money I got from government. We worked in a task force to help people firstly with kind of personal loans to help them through difficulties with mortgages or rents and so on. We got payments so that companies, if they took on a former steel worker, they would get a wage subsidy to help them take people on. We got people loans so they could start up their own businesses. We managed to get the DWP to actually change some of its rules around kind of benefit support so that they could get emergency help to people. We got millions of pounds into retraining, so everyone had access to free retraining through the colleges. There was a big, you know, local partnership pulling together that made all that happen with the colleges, with the local authorities, with the trade unions and with ourselves. So hopefully we mitigated the kind of worst of it, but it was still a horrendous time. You know, I'd have surgeries where, you know, grown men would be crying because, you know, they'd lost everything. They'd lost their identity. They'd lost their ability to feed their families. There were lots of relationship breakdowns. You know, there were suicides for years to come after that as a consequence. It was really, really horrendous. And so much of that formed, say, you know, particularly my views on Brexit and things that I tried to do afterwards, because I just tried desperately to protect the community from anything like that happening again. And I guess, you know, you could analyse how much that fed into people feeling like they were the global tides could come and go and people could be left behind and no one was there to defend them and stand up for them, and they would keep completely at the behest of these global steel companies or changes in global markets and left to rot. And I think a lot of that kind of fueled the sort of the grievance and the anger that played out in the years to come after that. So it was, yeah, it was hugely powerful, and we, you know, still struggling with it now. Ironically, there's now, you know, the site is now, we have a Conservative Tees Valley mayor who is you know, regenerating the site. We'll see what comes of that. Lots of promises of lots of jobs, lots of press releases and Facebook posts about lots of jobs, so we'll see what happens. But you know, the people here deserve every opportunity. They deserve, you know, great jobs, great skilled jobs, and we have a great opportunity to have a kind of new green industrial hub here, and I just hope the government will support that.
The Dorman Long Tower, I've seen all week on social media about the demolition of it. Opinion fairly evenly split, it seems, on whether it should or shouldn't have been demolished. I mean, I understand why people get attached to these things. I remember when I worked at Paddy Tipping in Sherwood, and there were some old headstocks of an old coal mine, and you know, half the community were like, they're an eyesore. The pit closed. Why is it still there? And other people, perhaps more closely associated with the mining industry, were like, well, I used to work there and it's a nice memory. I mean, these things are always tricky, but did it need to be demolished, do you think?
No, it didn't need to be. It was, I mean, there was already a campaign last year to save the blast furnace for sort of icon for culture, of creating visitor destination. I was less convinced about the arguments for that because of this huge size of it, the footprint of it and the cost. But the Dorman Long Tower is not big. And I used to get the train, if you took there's a fantastic train that goes from Middlesbrough out to Saltburn on the coast, and it used to go right through the heart of the industry. And when, you know, the steelworks were working, you could see the sparks flying. You could see, you know, it was fabulous, kind of real, kind of Mad Max sort of landscape. And it was incredible. And the Dorman Long Tower was there, standing huge. And that name is so iconic. You know, it built the world. It built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. It was the greatest steel and iron producer of the British Empire. And that is a source of massive, massive pride for people in this area. And they, you know, people would say my grandparents worked there, my great grandparents, you know, everybody, you know, this area really, Teesside, only really came into creation kind of 250 years ago. It's an industrial area. So the industry is the beating heart of this place. And, you know, when the steelworks closed, I think the government totally underestimated how important the industry is to the sort of, to the culture and the identity of people here. So I had a guy who was studying at university, and he said, I left because I wanted to go and work. There was a good job coming up in the steelworks, and my dad had worked there, my granddad had worked there, my cousins worked there. So I went and did that because that's who I am. I had another steelworker who's had a baby born quite recently after the steelworks was shut, and on the, you know, form it said occupation, he said, I put steelworker because that's what I'll always be. That's who I am. Whatever job I'm doing, I'll always be a steelworker. And so that all that kind of sense of identity, and, you know, the motto of Middlesbrough, Eremus, you know, we will be the infant Hercules, all of that kind of thing about this industrial giant whose best days lay ahead of it is really, really powerful. And I think it would have, you know, yes, it would have cost money to preserve that building and to create something positive from it, but it's not a huge scale. And I think my frustration, really, the biggest frustration, was how it was handled. There was no consultation with the public. There was no attempt to reach out to some of the many brilliant organisations we have in this country, you know, 20th Century Society and others who do the fundraising around this heritage. You know, there was no attempt to list it, to protect it, until a member of the public did that right at the last minute. That money could be raised if there'd been a proper kind of campaign and a proper strategy around it, but it was just brushed aside. And I understand the priority for jobs, I totally do, but I don't believe that the small area that this covers in what is the biggest industrial site in Europe, I don't believe that would have got in the way of the job creation. I think something fundamentally could have been done to create a brilliant culture icon, to light it up, to have climbing walls, to have, you know, stuff going on in there. We have Beamish, which attracts a huge number of people in this region to see the kind of industrial and coal mining glory of the past. We should celebrate that. It's part of what this area is about, and it doesn't need to be destroyed to make way for the future.
And landmarks are so important for the identity of an area. It feels like a peculiar decision. However, as well as the £50 million that you got out of the government to help with the sort of collapse of the steelwork industry in your constituency, probably your biggest success was as chair of the all-party group on bingo. Do you still play bingo? And what did the all-party group do?
I love bingo. And, you know, bingo is one of those things that, again, it's so fundamental to communities, particularly for women. I love going into kind of bingo halls and bingo events in Redcar because they're so welcoming. For a lot of women, they were kind of a safe place. The networks were always there. The gossip was always brilliant. And, you know, I used to say my advice to any aspiring candidate or MP is, when you're playing, if you do get a line or bingo, do not say so. Sit quietly on it, because you the numbers of vote. I made that mistake very early on by calling bingo, and the scowls and the chuntering and the furious looks I got from 100 people around the hall. I learned my lesson very quickly that never ever never to call bingo if you're lucky enough to get there. Just sit quietly with your dabber and get on with it.
And do you think number 10 will be Keir's den in the next 4 or 5 years?
I like what you've done there. It's got to be. You know, and everyone's got to just focus on that, because we can't afford to have another term for this government. I mean, I sit and watch from my kind of spectator seat now in absolute horror of what they're doing to this country. You know, having lost friends last year who died needlessly because of the complete mishandling and mismanagement of this pandemic, to see the country like grinding to a halt with food supplies, with, you know, fuel. I've just been to queue up myself outside the petrol station, couldn't believe it. You know, I just how they're getting away with this. And that's before you start on, you know, all the other worrying approaches that they're taking to democracy, whether that's, you know, the ID and trying to suppress voting, whether, you know, it's the way they deal with the Charity Commission and others to suppress that, the whole number of kind of freedoms and democratic issues that really concern me, that, you know, before we even get into the PPE and the absolutely disgraceful channeling of public money to mates. I mean, I'm just kind of breathless every day with the absolute sheer horror of this government. And so Keir has to win. We have to win. And that everyone just needs to focus, pull the fingers out, do the work, you know. I love my colleagues dearly in Parliament, but everyone's got to step up. Everyone's got to be, you know, doing more, saying more, taking the fight out there, because we've got to win the next election. It's absolutely fundamental.
And have you spoken to him much since he became leader, or since you lost your seat?
We have the odd text exchange or bits and pieces. Quite often on the Arsenal, actually. The last text was on the Arsenal. But yeah, you know, I've got a good relationship with Keir. But I try not to. I'd love to text him every day with my thoughts and views and things. But he doesn't need to hear that. He's got enough people telling him what to do. So I just let him get on with it. But I'll be there in Brighton, and you know, looking forward to hearing his speech. And I know people have kind of. Yeah, it's been a mixed response to this, the Fabian piece is put out. But I think, you know, great, let's get the vision. I mean, I'm very much more of a pledge card sort of person myself. But actually, one of the things Tony Blair often did say was that beneath the pledge card was a huge amount of work, a huge amount of thinking, a huge amount of graft. And then you sort of distill it. So for me, it's great that we're really now, there's a vision here, there's the start, there's a kind of direction. So let's start to really hone this now into clear, you know, campaigning messages that resonate with people, that are practical and realistic, but are also significant and radical as well. And I think he can do that. The urgency is now.
So funny the reaction to him writing that essay, because on the one hand people say, oh, we haven't got any detail, we don't know what it's about. And then he says, well, here's a long explanation of what I'm about. And people go, it's too long. You're like, well, it's not like he's taking that out at election time. He's doing that now to set out his stall. It's perfectly legitimate. And I wish more people would do that. I'd be interested to read pamphlets on what more politicians actually thought.
Exactly. It's quite kind of old school in a way, but I really like it. And, you know, I think it's ironic that some of the people like John McDonnell complaining about, I think these are the guys who love a pamphlet. You know, they love a long kind of, you know, treatise. And so no, I've got no problem with that. But that's kind of, that's just one aspect. And that's for a certain audience. And, you know, let's focus on the video. Let's focus on the messaging. Let's focus on the kind of clear, concise pledges for people. Let's now build the kind of vision for Britain, and a positive, hopeful vision that's you know, going to come out of, well, I hope people will feel the challenges that this country faces, and look to Labour to say, yep, they're the ones that I think have got the answers. Excuse me. And they're the ones that want to build the kind of country that I want to be in, and that I can see that guy in number 10 and dealing with the rest of the world and building the kind of country that I want to see.
And are you excited about conference? Obviously, there wasn't one last year. Labour conferences historically can really vary between quite joyous moments and internecine warfare. What sort of party do you expect to see when you're down in Brighton?
Well, I'm quite intrigued, and that's one of the reasons why I want to go, because I missed a couple of years as well before last year. So I've missed it. I love conference. I love catching up with old friends. I love the buzz, the ideas, the conversations, the karaoke. I love the sense of being amongst people who, you know, you're part of a family with. That's what it's always been. That's how it should be. And I'm interested to see whether that's, you know, I really hope this is where the party is. I'll be devastated if I get a sense of, you know, the sort of excuse me, the resentment or the nastiness that's plagued the party in the last few years. I just think that's got to go. You know, we've got to move on. We've got to focus on the public. We've got to stop kind of, you know, the bitching and moaning, and we've just got to get on with doing what needs to be done. So I'm hoping that we have a really positive conference, and that we present a party to the public that people say, yeah, I recognize that they I want them to set out a vision for Britain that I can buy into. That's what conference should be about.
You mentioned karaoke then. Do you have any particular songs that are your favorites to do at karaoke?
Oh god I'm a lover of power ballads, 80s power ballads. So always a bit of Bonnie Tyler on the agenda for me. But yeah, I'll hopefully there'll be no video evidence surfacing from next week.
Well, if you're going to the Labour Party conference and you see Anna Turley singing karaoke, please tweet that video. Anna, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, there you go, Anna Turley, with so much inspiring pragmatism. I was going to say it's rare. I'm not sure it is. I think there are a lot of pragmatists in politics on all sides. I just think the way politics went, and it still is over the last few years, and still is now, means that the noisier, really sometimes sillier voices get more attention than those people who are just trying to sort the problems of the world out. And Anna Turley is one of those people trying to sort problems out. Obviously faced a number of her own problems, not least that legal action against Unite, which she won. And just that incredible revelation about these forums where members of her own party were sharing information on these forums that have been started by the far right. Oh, I imagine there's a film in that somewhere. But anyway, what a pleasure it was to talk to Anna Turley at the start of Labour Party Conference Week. And of course, in a couple of days' time, I'm joined by Andy Burnham on Monday, the 27th of September. You can get tickets to that at mattford.com/live and all future political party dates. I cannot tell you how excited I am for this show to be back on stage. That was how it was first conceived. It's really how it always meant to be. I cannot wait to be back on stage doing them. So I hope to see you there. I hope you're keeping well. And I hope you're enjoying this gradual unlocking. It does feel that incrementally, life is becoming more normal. Still very aware of all the risks there. But nevertheless, it feels like we can all do a bit more now. And that is a very enjoyable and pleasurable thing. Hopefully, I'll see you at the Duchess Theatre soon. Take care. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.